Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. The first 6 months of President Trump's second term in the Oval Office has seen immigration enforcement run through communities such as those in Los Angeles. In response to those immigration raids, thousands of people in LA took to the streets in protests. In response to those protests, the Trump administration federalized the National Guard without the request of California's governor and against the requests of local law enforcement, a move which has not been taken since 1965 when it was used to enforce desegregation. Following that escalation, the administration went one step further, authorizing the deployment of American Marines on the streets of L.A. Joining me now is Dakota Rudisill, an associate professor with the Moritz College of Law at Ohio State University. He studies national security, legislation and regulation, and secrecy and surveillance. Dakota, welcome to All Sides.
Great to be here.
So why did the administration claim they needed to federalize the National Guard and also deploy Marines in Los Angeles?
Well, President Trump, in his June 7 directive to the administration, is claiming that there's a situation of rebellion in Los Angeles against federal authority. And what he's looking there to is protests against immigration enforcement actions by ICE. The overwhelming amount of which, looking at just the number of people involved, have been peaceful, but there have been a number of people varying by, you know, incident from, you know, one or two people to and a couple other incidents. There were, you know, many, many dozen people who were doing things like throwing water bottles, pushing and shoving, throwing rocks, things of that nature. So the president has looked at this and said this is rebellion against federal authority, and then invoked a federal law, 10 U.S.C. 12406, that allows the president to call out the National Guard under federal authority to deal with rebellion or danger of rebellion. The president, in his June 7 order, also, as you mentioned, gave the Secretary of Defense the authority to send in basically regular U.S. troops. And the Secretary of Defense decided to mobilize 700 Marines. So that's how the administration sees this. And the Marines have been mobilized under a separate authority, basically the argument that the president always has the authority to defend federal facilities and federal personnel. So that's the administration's view. A lot of criticism of this, however, because, our norm in this country is that law enforcement, including by the federal government, is conducted by civilians. We do not have a militarized society. So this is unusual in that respect. And a lot of questions, too, about, whether, a number of dozen people getting violent, is that rebellion against the federal government, or is that just, is that crime? Is that people at a protest who are making, the poor decision, right, to cross from First Amendment protected free speech to using violence? And so a lot of big issues involved here.
Yeah, the police chief for the LA Police Department said they did not require assistance in dealing with the protests because, as you said, they saw it as not a rebellion, but as a few members of the protests making bad decisions, and they wanted to handle it at a local level. Is that unusual for an administration, the president, to override the local police department?
Yeah, I mean, this is certainly extraordinary. As you mentioned, the last time that a president mobilized National Guard forces over the objection of a state governor was 1965. So that's a long time ago. Mm-hmm. The last time that this particular provision of law was used, 10 U.S.C. 12406, was 1970. So this is extraordinary stuff, as in really unusual and defiant of norms in the United States, where we have basically there are kind of two big norms, or kind of structural elements of our constitutional order. One is separation of civilian law enforcement and the military, and then the second is we have a default that localities and states are responsible for public order, not the federal government. The federal government does foreign affairs, and it deals with really, really big deal things, such as, like rebellion, like imagine, the Confederacy, right? Rebelling against federal authority. Or during George Washington's term as president, there was an armed rebellion in Western Pennsylvania, the Whiskey Rebellion. That was a large scale, tens of thousands of people taking up arms. I mean, that was a rebellion. Is a couple dozen people, throwing water bottles and rocks, is that a rebellion, or is that, just some civil disorder? And certainly the administration is taking, I think, the most expansive view of the term rebellion that I think has ever been taken in the history of the country. So there's definitely pushback.
Now, you mentioned this phrase of the rebellion. Were the president's actions constitutional? Is that a part of, is that in the Constitution, this idea of stopping a rebellion?
Yeah, so in the Constitution, Congress is given the power to write laws to allow the president to call out the term at the founding of the country was militia. Today, we have a professionalized National Guard, which is the professionalized militia. So Congress has constitutional authority to write laws that give the president the authority to call out the National Guard. To deal with the situations that I mentioned, invasion of the country, rebellion within the country, unable to enforce federal law, something of that nature. And so Congress, has written these laws, and the president is invoking them. And the president, under the Constitution, is the commander in chief of federal military forces, not the commander of the country, like the Roman emperor, but commander of the military. And so there certainly is constitutional basis here for what the president is doing. Again, so much of this is going to turn on how we understand these terms in the statute, 12406, that are not defined. Congress just said that is giving the president authority to call out the National Guard if there's rebellion or danger of rebellion against the federal government. But Congress did not take the time to define rebellion. And so the president is doing that. And typically, courts are pretty deferential to the president in interpreting those provisions. So I think, so my prediction actually would be if this goes all the way to the Supreme Court, I suspect that President Trump will win on this. But of course, that's not the final word. Congress can always come back and amend the statute to narrow the authority. Congress could defund it. Congress could write limits on what the president could do with the National Guard or the Marines. So there are other process steps that our Constitution envisions.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the use of Marines and the National Guard in Los Angeles during anti-ICE protests with Moritz College of Law professor Dakota Rudisill. Now, we mentioned that the last time this was used in a similar manner was 1965. That was related to desegregation. You also mentioned 1970. Were there bottles being thrown? Was it violent? Or in the desegregation situation, was it more so that the governor was just defying federal law?
Yeah, so during the civil rights years in the 1950s and the 1960s, much, much clearer and easier to understand why the president would use the president's authority under a number of statutes, this one and another one that's called the Insurrection Act. So President Eisenhower, President Kennedy, and President Johnson, all three of them invoked the Insurrection Act. One of them also used this statute that President Trump used in situations where the U.S. Supreme Court and other courts had ruled that segregation in the South, segregation of blacks and whites, is illegal. And there were governors of Southern states, there were mayors of cities, police forces, even the National Guard in the South that were defying federal court orders. And so, three presidents, blue and red, reasonably made the decision that basically these states were in rebellion against federal authority, invoked the Insurrection Act and this other statute, took the National Guard forces away from those Southern governors, which is completely legal under these statutes because those National Guard forces were being used to defy federal law, and also send in federal regular forces, including the 101st Airborne, to integrate schools in the South consistent with court order. So that's super, a super easy case. Definitely controversial at the time, but really, really easy. I think this is a much harder case. Again, like, you know, a couple people or, you know, a couple dozen people throwing rocks and bottles is nothing like, you know, the governor of a southern state defying the Supreme Court on, you know, on racial integration. I mean, that's it's very, very different. The other case that was mentioned here was 1970. And in 1970, there was a postal strike in New York City and the mail was not getting delivered. And so President Nixon invoked this 12406 law to have the New York National Guard deliver mail in New York City. It was not violent. It was just, we're going to use the National Guard to deliver federal mail, right? That seems, again, to me, like a very, very different case than, you know, certainly the defiance of federal courts by, you know, Southern governors during the civil rights movement again. But also, I think also different, just of a different, you know, cats and dogs. It's just kind of a different thing than what we're seeing right now in Los Angeles.
Now, Governor Newsom of California sued the Trump administration for control of the California National Guard. That lawsuit is proceeding. I know you can't predict the future, but do you think we'll have a decision in that soon?
Yeah, I think so. So the district judge in California ruled for the governor of California and against the Trump administration, and I think had reasonable basis to do so, saying, again, just the, you know, the small number of people who are being violent does not amount to a rebellion. Calling out the Trump administration on not complying with the process that is stipulated in the law for how this is done. The law is very clear that the orders for putting the California National Guard on federal duty have to go through the governor of California. Mm-hmm. But Trump's Defense Department just blew right by that and sent it directly to the National Guard in California. So I think that the district judge in California had a good basis for the ruling that he had. Yesterday at noon, there was a hearing for the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the next kind of it's between district courts and the Supreme Court. And so they're gonna review the district court decision. And then I think depending on how that comes out, I think it probably will get appealed to the Supreme Court. And again, my instinct here is that I think that President Trump actually probably will win in the end on this because of the deference that courts generally have towards the president as the commander in chief. And also because, again, Congress did not do the best job when it wrote this law in failing to define rebellion. And I think it's fairly clear that Congress was thinking of something like, you know, like states rebelling against the, you know, like something like the Civil War, right? Or the Whiskey Rebellion in Western Pennsylvania with tens of thousands of Americans taking up arms against the federal government. I don't think they were talking about two dozen people with rocks and bottles of water. But Congress didn't do their work in defining it. So that's my sense.
Now, I wanted to turn to the military parade that was held recently in Washington, D.C., because some comparisons have been made between the images of Marines in the streets of L.A. compared to that parade. What's your take on that comparison? Because during the president's first term, he wanted a similar parade, but it ended up being canceled due to cost. And at that time, you wrote an essay calling on Congress to ban these types of parades. So again, you're calling on Congress to do a better job. So can you talk to me about this contrast of the Marines in L.A. and this military parade happening in D.C.?
Yeah. Well, the common thread of both of them is domestic use of the armed forces in a way which is not consistent with the tradition that we've had in this country. So my research has shown that in the last century, we've only had three large military parades until this most recent Saturday, with the president reviewing the troops. And that was after U.S. victories in World War I, World War II, and the 1991 Persian Gulf War. So large victories for the United States military in war, and there were, you know, parades before the president, right? But the norm has been in the United States that we don't do what so many dictatorships do, right? You know, the Soviets and the Russians with Red Square marches every year, North Korea, the People's Republic of China, you know, with the oceans of marching troops and tanks and things like that. So our norm has been that we don't have that. And in a big, big departure from American traditions, Trump's team, from the time that Trump was elected, was asking the Pentagon explicitly, these were their words, they want a Red Square, North Korea-style parade for the president of the U.S. military. And that is definitely against our traditions. And President Trump, in his first term, got strong pushback from the uniformed military and from his own appointees at the Defense Department, who thought these authoritarian optics would be terrible, and it would cost about $50 million and tear up the streets in D.C. So it didn't happen the first time around. This time around, Trump has put in place people in the Defense Department that have been very carefully screened to make sure they will do pretty much anything he wants. And they also, early, as people may recall, at the start of the administration, basically decapitated the uniformed military by dismissing many top four-star generals and admirals. And so that just sent a signal, we're not going to tolerate any pushback. And so it happened. And, you know, I think, again, I think that those traditions we have are really, really important. I'm a strong supporter of our armed forces and honoring the Army on its 250th birthday. But there are all sorts of things that we can do to honor the armed forces, right, that don't involve us, you know, following, you know, this kind of Red Square Nuremberg model with, you know, with marching troops. I just don't think that's our tradition. And I think that we should only, you know, I think, like I said, I think Congress can and should just legislate a flat ban on like presidential military parades, absent something like, again, like a victory in like a World War II type conflict. You know, other than that, I would leave honoring our military to, you know, to a parade, you know, smaller parades in states and localities that are not attended by the national leader, and you know, just other ways that we can honor and thank our troops in uniform for, you know, all the wonderful things that they do for us. But again, I just think we have a long tradition in our country of not having our streets be Red Square, and I think we should go back to that.
All right, so we'll leave it with Congress needs to define rebellion and Congress needs to be able to approve these parades, right? Well,
yes.
All right.
Yes.
That was Associate Professor of the Moritz College of Law, Dakota Rudisill. Dakota, thank you so much for joining me today.
Great to be here.
And coming up, we're going to talk about the administration's immigration enforcement and the ensuing protests, the anti-ICE protests. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Immigration enforcement has been one of the highest priorities of the Trump administration in its first few months. ICE agents have been raiding areas across the country, searching for illegal immigrants and grabbing many others in the crossfire. However, when agents began to raid farms and hotels where many illegal immigrants are employed by big business owners, the president put out a statement saying that those immigrants were, quote, actually good, and that the enforcement at those places would stop. Joining me to discuss the administration's immigration enforcement around the country and here in Ohio is the director of the Ohio Immigrant Alliance, Lynn Tremonti. Lynn, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
So we've heard news about immigration raids in big cities, L.A., Miami, Chicago. Have there been many big raids here in Ohio, or is it smaller one-on-one arrests?
Look, I want to say the president already walked back his brief moment of sanity when he said he wasn't going to raid farms and factories. Stephen Miller is really in charge. Mm-hmm. The gloves are off. ICE masked agents are raiding Kroger grocery store parking lots in Cincinnati. Local police and remote corners of Ohio are handing people over to ICE and the Border Patrol. We are a police state. Ohio doesn't just have ICE agents. We have the Border Patrol along the northern part of Ohio. And unfortunately, Ohio does have many people who have been taken away from their families already because of this aggressive approach to ripping people out of our homes and communities.
Do you feel like there's been a noticeable trend behind the locations and methods of these raids over the past few months? I mean, you mentioned the Kroger parking lot thing. We've heard a lot about, you know, they're saying like, send ICE to Home Depot parking lots. That have you seen? What have you seen about the locations around the country?
They're coming to immigration courts where people are trying to follow the law and get through a process to get legal immigration status. They are arresting people who actually go to the immigration offices who are complying with the law. People are showing up and they're being arrested as they're complying with the law. It doesn't make any sense. President Trump is taking immigration status away from people who have it currently. He has canceled immigration legal programs for people from Haiti, Cameroon, Venezuela. These are people who came here legally on planes the way that we told them to. They have sponsors here. You know, it doesn't make any sense. There's a young man, a soccer star who just graduated from high school in Cincinnati, who is now in a staging facility in Louisiana, almost on a plane back to Honduras. He has a visa waiting for him in a government office in the United States that one branch of the government says he qualifies for, while the ICE agency says we have to quickly deport him. None of it makes any sense. And this is chaos. So the Trump administration said they were going to make us safer. They were going to have this great immigration policy that we were going to all love. Nobody feels safer. Nobody feels like this makes sense. It's chaos. It's confusion. It's tearing families apart. And it has to stop.
Now, we mentioned at the beginning this idea of the president suspending raids on farms and hotels and then that being walked back. It is a little confusing as to who to believe and what's actually happening regarding the raids on farms and hotels. But why do you think farms and hotels ended up becoming, you know, a part of this where they're saying, oh, no, no, the ones who work in hotels are fine?
Look, we're all part of one community. We all eat food. We all, you know, we all go to hotels, we all eat at restaurants, we all purchase products made in factories in Ohio. Like we are interdependent. And it's not that only immigrants work on farms or that only immigrants work in factories. American citizens work in these places too. Places like Springfield, Ohio, Willard, Ohio, Lake County, Ashtabula County. These are places in Ohio that used to be only Americans lived there. I'm from a small town in Ohio. And now they're vibrant because it's a mix of immigrants and U.S. citizens. But these are places that would die because the citizens are leaving and they're being replaced with immigrants. But now it's a mix of everybody. So we need each other. And I think that's what some people realize, is that we're all part of one community together. When you take immigrants out and you only leave citizens, then you're missing half the population and then the towns will die. So we need each other. We're part of one community. And you can't just remove 25% of the population and expect a town like Willard or Springfield to survive. It's not going to happen. And Ohio will wrinkle and die like a raisin if we get rid of 25% of the population of our small towns.
Now, Governor DeWine yesterday voiced concerns over parts of the Trump administration's immigration enforcement. Do you feel like there's something that the governor can do, even though things at the national level seem rather confusing? What are your thoughts on what Governor DeWine could or should be doing?
I love that Ohio used to have an independent streak. Republicans used to be willing to stand up and say, we're going to do the right thing. They used to be willing to say, you know, the Republicans that claimed Christian values, we're going to stick with our Christian values. I haven't seen that in about 15 years. I was in D.C. when Mike DeWine was a senator. I remember when he was a member of the Judiciary Committee, and he actually stood up and stood up against some members of his party when they were doing the wrong things on immigration. I have not seen that. lately I've seen him, you know, towing the Republican line, the Trump line. I have seen Bernie Moreno saying some extremely shameful things about the assassinations of Minnesota politicians. There were Ohio lawmakers on that hit list, and I have not seen our Republican senators saying anything remotely appropriate or Christian, quite honestly, about our Ohio lawmakers who were on that hit list. It's time to set aside partisanship. It's been past time to set aside partisanship, come together as a state. Ohio Republicans could show leadership. Immigration, our community of Springfield was attacked. Our entire community of Springfield was attacked. And the Republican mayor showed leadership. Our Republican governor could follow his example and show leadership too. And just say, enough is enough. We're not going to have masked agents in our communities tearing people apart. We're not going to unleash the military on our own communities and tear our communities apart. We're going to come together. We're going to reject what Washington's doing. And we're going to demand better from our federal government. So I think that we could see that. I think the governor has shown leadership before, but it was about 20 years ago. So I think that I know he can do it. I've seen him do it before. I just haven't seen it in a while.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about immigration enforcement with the director of the Ohio Immigrant Alliance, Lynn Tremonti. Now, Governor DeWine says that he is hearing from companies that are concerned about losing workers. He's talked before about the concerns for Springfield, and you mentioned the concerns for Springfield. The Haitian population is a big part of that community. Do you feel that in Springfield in particular, because Springfield became such a hot button issue, that we're going to see more happening in Springfield in the coming months? Because the temporary protected status of many of the Haitians in Springfield is up in August. What are your worries for Springfield?
Yeah, let's think about Haitians, for example, for a minute. Haitians love their country. They have beaches. They have great food. They did not want to leave their country. So Haitians have been traveling from continent to continent to literally save their children's lives. They went to South America, they were rejected. They came to Ohio, they said, this is a great place to live. Springfield is nice. There were already Haitians living there. They settled there. They said, okay, this is a great small town. There's jobs, we can rent houses, we can work towards buying a house. And then they were told by some people that we are not wanted here. And then outside agitators came in and started assaulting them and making bomb threats and closing the school. The violence was brought in by this hateful rhetoric, and it came in from the outside. Haitians didn't bring violence. It came in from the outside. How many times do they have to save their own lives? We're talking about heroic, brave, strong people. And again, they're told by the highest levels of the U.S. government, you have to find a new home again. The thing that I see in Springfield, though, is the outpouring of love from the community, the religious community, regular people. I mean, there's the Springfield was attacked, and so many people in Springfield are putting their arms around Haitians and saying, we don't want you to have to leave. So this is another area where the governor and our state leadership, they have a lot to do and to push back on the federal government to say, you know what, this is not fair. These are our people. These are Haitian Ohioans. They belong here. Find a solution for them so that they can stay. They've already saved their lives and their kids' lives 1,000 times, and they deserve to settle and stay somewhere safe and stay in Ohio.
There have been a lot of anti-ICE protests around the country, most notably in LA, which we talked about earlier in the show. But do you feel like the anti-ICE protests, is that the right reaction? Is that enough reaction? Besides what you're saying of people, you know, calling on lawmakers lawmakers in Ohio to act against the federal government, what do you think of what I guess what's your take on all the anti-ICE protests?
So it's so scary to see somebody in a mask coming up to somebody on the street, grabbing them off the street, throwing them in a van, and driving away from them. And we're seeing scene after scene of that every day. It's happening in Ohio. It's happening around the country. It's a normal reaction for Americans to say, I don't want that happening in my country. when I was in elementary school, we were learning about history, world history, and we were shown scenes of that happening in other countries, and we were told that is fascism and that started wars, that started the world wars. That was what you should fight against. That is authoritarianism, and America stands against that. And it's happening right now on our streets in Ohio. We can't let that happen.
Now, I wanted to ask you about some things your organization is doing specifically to help immigrants in Ohio. Your organization, the Ohio Immigrant Alliance, you run an Ohio immigrant hotline. Can you tell me more about this hotline, what it is, what it does, what happens when you call it?
Absolutely. So you can call the hotline at 419-777-HELP, HELP, 4357. You could email the hotline at hotline@ohioimmigrant.org. We're able to take calls in any language. You can also leave messages and send the emails. And we have amazing hotline managers. They are so happy to take your phone calls. And we will handle whatever you need. If you have a question, you need to figure out how you can get an immigration lawyer in a different part of the state. Unfortunately, we get a lot of phone calls of people trying to find loved ones who've disappeared. That is one of the most heartbreaking phone calls we get. We get a lot of phone calls of people who are locked in immigration jails. You go to immigration jail when you are arrested by ICE. You are not charged with a crime. You are put in immigration jail when you are being accused of being here without legal immigration status. It's a civil offense. They put you in a criminal jail in Ohio, a county jail. You're subject to the same conditions as a criminal jail. The only thing is, you don't know when you're getting out. You don't have a sentence. It could be indefinite. So we get a lot of calls from jails in Ohio, and they're pretty scary, the calls that we're getting about how people are being treated in these jails. We already have one lawsuit pending against the Butler County Jail from 2020 about abuses and assaults against immigrants. And I will tell you, the treatment is ongoing at that jail. And that's all I can say right now, but it's ongoing. And we know what's happening in that jail. We are documenting the information, and we have lawyers that we're working with. So we are taking down this information. You can call the hotline if you've been treated, if you've been abused by local police. If you've got any questions, we're here to help. Anything related to being an immigrant in Ohio, it can be also if you need a speaker for an event, the Ohio Immigrant Hotline, it's just a one-stop shop. If you've got questions about immigration in Ohio, we will try to help you. We can't help everybody, and we can't give legal advice. But I'm so proud that we have this hotline. It's something that we didn't have during the first Trump administration. So it's a new feature that we have, and we have already been able to help so many people through the hotline. Our hotline managers are amazing. And then there's a whole network of volunteers around the state affiliated with all kinds of local groups. If you go to ohioishome.org, you can find out some of the local groups, the regional groups. I mean, Ohio has a huge volunteer heart. And Ohio has a lot of people from various faith traditions, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, very many different faith traditions who are just opening their homes and hearts to help people because this is a time of struggle for a lot of people. And I'm very proud of the volunteer and the caring nature of so many people around Ohio who are involved in this work.
Has your hotline seen an increase in the number of people who have called in recent weeks? I know you said that there wasn't a hotline in the first Trump administration, so it
Right.
might be hard to like gauge numbers, I guess. But have you seen an uptick?
We've definitely seen an uptick since we started a video series. We've been able to put out videos in multiple languages promoting the hotline. And then we've also seen a huge increase of calls from the jails, the detention centers. During the first Trump administration, we were able to actually close two ICE contracts with Ohio jails because of massive abuses that were taking place at the Butler County Jail and the Morrow County Jail. And immigrants bravely spoke up and helped file lawsuits against those jails. And we closed two ICE contracts. Recently, the Trump administration reopened several jail contracts. So detention has increased dramatically, and we've seen a huge increase in our calls. Unfortunately, there's a lot of bad things happening in the jails right now, and we're getting a lot of phone calls about it.
And just quickly before we end, I wanted to ask you, you said you have the ability to, someone can call up and ask for a speaker. Is that kind of the know your rights kind of speakers? Are you going around Ohio and trying to teach people to understand what they can and can and shouldn't do if approached by someone?
We're doing some of that. Many groups are doing that. And gosh, I mean, immigrants know their rights. They know so much about American civics, constitution. They know more than the Secretary of Homeland Security about the U.S. immigration law and civics and the constitution. That's for sure. We're doing some of that, but we're also talking to community groups. We're talking to churches. You know, a lot of people want to know, they want to understand, why is it that people are being arrested and put in jail for immigration stuff? They don't understand it because they think that the immigration laws work more fairly than they do. And they just don't understand why there's all this stuff happening. So we do have to go around and talk to people that the laws, they were created by like a lot of misinformation, you know. And there's actually, if we could talk for a minute about the Ohio legislature is considering all these bills that try to get involved in immigration law. They're considering these bills that don't know anything about immigration law. So they would make the system worse. The laws don't work at all the way American people think they do or should. So we have to just go around and explain to people that you think the laws work one way. They work a totally different way. They don't work the way they did when, you know, for example, my family came here in the early, you know, 20th century. So it's a lot of explaining. And then we have, you know, let people know it doesn't work the way you thought they do. And, you know, let's talk about what it could look like instead, what a logical system would look like.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. That was the director of the Ohio Immigrant Alliance, Lynn Tremonte. Lynn, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
And coming up, we are going to be talking with about President Trump's recently announced travel ban and how it will impact the immigrant community in Central Ohio. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
Actually, first of all, thank you for inviting me. Secondly, this is a second time that the Somali community faced this rule. And as you know, the Somalis are not new in this country. Back in a little bit of history, back in 1993, there was when civil war broke out in Somalia, the United States sent troops to save millions of Somalis who were at the verge of starvation and actually saved millions and millions of people. Then the United States allowed a number of Somalis to immigrate to in United States and to establish their lives from scratch, different states in the United States. And America has still military bases in Somalia. And also it helps a lot, the country we came from. So people who survived from that horrific situation at that time, actually some of them are in Columbus, Ohio. And they were not expecting us. They have a lot of credit, respect to the United States, what they have done for them and their families and the country. So they were not expected to be singled them out. Call it like, we had a Muslim ban before, but now it's so many countries has been put on the list. So the reaction is we're not expecting, and it's so horrific. Something that you don't like your kids or your family or your friends or anybody to feel different from the rest of your community, your neighbors, your classmates, your coworkers. because that's a question that comes up. What's wrong with your guys when you don't have an answer whatsoever?
What does this travel ban mean for Somali immigrants who, say, wish to go back and see loved ones, or if you need to go back to Somalia to handle any personal business? What does the travel ban mean for that?
Travel ban, actually, people have experienced the last time, I think it was first Trump administration. A lot of people face a lot of challenge, even when they visit, even when they are the United States citizen and visit their family members in Somalia. When they come back, they actually encounter so many questions, and they face it, you know, thorough investigations, some of them. And we know that Somalis came to America and they contributed in a lot when it comes to, for example, in Columbus, we developed it. There's economic development. We are taxi bearers. We workforce. So there's no issue that makes us different. But when you travel, you're different. And when you come back to the country, you get a lot of questions that you are not expecting, and also do not know where it came from and how it had happened. So we are peaceful and law-abiding community, honestly. And we're American, and we're enjoying the life here because we educate our kids, we get better life. We are doing good. Also, we love this country.
And if much of Central Ohio Somali population, if a lot came in the 1990s, whenever the United States brought people here to avoid the famine, that means that if they stayed here and had children, a lot of their children or even grandchildren at this point are citizens through birthright citizenship. So that leads to another question. What are the concerns of the Central Ohio Somali community when we talk about birthright citizenship?
Actually, that's not concerned only the Somalis. This is a national issue, and it affected everybody. But since we have already put on the list of country cannot be allowed to come to the United States or visit, I think that gives us additional something that we're not expecting. So I hope there is a constitution has been established a long time ago, and we're not alone. So we have an alliance. We have so many Americans who their parents are not born in this country, but we came as a legal. We came as a legal. We did not come in as an illegal immigrant. We've been processed and vetted by INS before we come to the United States in refugee camps. And we're allowed lawful to enter to the United States. So we're not considering our kids, our birth, the foreign, we're not foreign. We were permanent residents when we have actually these families and these kids came upon in the United States.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the newly announced travel ban with the executive director of the Somali Community Association of Ohio, Hassan Omar. Now, we mentioned that there was the same travel ban in the first Trump administration, and then President Biden, when he took office, he overturned that. So during that 4-year period in between the two Trump administrations, did people travel back and forth to Somalia, you know, visit family, have family visit here? Was it easier?
I don't have the list of the people who travel back to Somalia and also come from Somalia, but what I know is so many people call us and share information. They've been stopped by when they came back to the airports, the border protection and immigration, and asking them so many questions in regard of where they visit and how long they've been there and what they've been doing there. So that questions, and it creates a lot of fear because we have a family back there. And not only that, the Somalis who live in the United States, Somalia is really weak, has a weak government. It cannot provide the service and the goods people need. So the Somali abroad who live in the United States or Europe or somewhere else are the lifeline for those people. So they see America as, you know, is highly respected nation. as a Somali. And I remember back in 1993, I was one of the consultants. I was with the US Marines, actually, consulting with them. And we used to call the noble people. That's what we call America before even they came. So when you have that mentality and everybody love this country, and then you get a ticket, say, hey, you cannot go across this lane, it makes you a little bit confused. But in general, we know this community is resilient. They've been in refugee camp for so long. They come to America, they work hard, they establish businesses, they educate their kids. You can get over 1,000 Somali nursing working in the hospitals in Central Ohio or Minnesota. You can find workforce paying the tax. You can find business owners, people who are born in America, they already have another children. So we are not a new immigrant. We've been here for almost like 4 decades. Mm-hmm. And America is our own land, our own country, and we're not going anywhere. So this kind of actually identify a little bit different from the rest of the community is not going to give us, to hesitate to continue working and doing something that we have been doing. And I hope the administration or the other people who are the leadership positions will change their mind and recognize it like this community and the other immigrants have a right to, visit their families and reunite their own families, those who are back in Somalia or the other places.
Have you heard at all from anyone with Governor DeWine's administration or even Columbus's mayor's office offering you support or help with these? Because these are federal things that are happening, but the state and even the city can step in and help. Have you heard anything from the state or the city?
I remember the first Muslim ban. There was only 7 countries at that time. The Franklin County actually invited all stakeholders, all departments, and also the immigrant groups to share with them and consult and give advice about what to do. So that time was really, but this time I don't see anyone actually talking about because it seems to me there's a huge movement when it comes to immigration issues. We've been seeing that, what's going on in California or Chicago or the other place in the United States. Therefore, we don't want to whine. And, we have part of the buses. We see what's going on. So we don't say wait and see, but hopefully things will get better soon. That's what I'm expecting to.
I read a Columbus Dispatch article where you were quoted, and you said that the children of people in the Somali community are being most affected by this just because they were born here for the most part and they feel like Americans. Do you feel like the children don't understand exactly what's going on?
Honestly, yeah, these kids, they are proud of they are, but they also want to feel like full Americans. They are asking, will this country accept me? Am I safe here? And why it is so important for leaders to speak out, to remind them. So the young people, those who are coming from who have questions a lot, because I have I have 6 children, honestly, and some of them graduated Ohio State. I'm back I fan. And then they always ask me, Dad, I graduated Ohio State. I'm a nurse. And I work. And then somebody told me, your country has been banned. You cannot come over here. So that question comes every home from the children. So they confuse a little bit. They don't understand because, when it's a kind of bully, because when somebody, your classmate, your coworker say, you're not allowed to this country, even somebody can tell you. And that makes a little bit, put the child in position where they cannot have an answer because they are not adult. So this is the biggest problem really that we face is the children. How to convince them and tell them why we've been singled them out, why we are separate from the rest. They even ask us, are you criminals? And we tell them, no, we're not criminals. Mm-hmm. Then why they imposed you to confine you and you cannot travel? So those are questions really the biggest as a young people.
I want to thank you so much for your time. You've been listening to Executive Director of the Somali Community Association of Ohio, Hassan Omar. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much and have a good day.
And this is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.